Okay, first off, I lied. I thought I was going to be done today, and I'm not. I will be done Monday, however, so you can be reasonably confident about that. Other preliminary questions? Issues? Okay, just to sort of place us in the larger scheme of things, we're working our way through the chapter on causation. We addressed the two aspects of causation, but-for cause and legal cause. The basic test for but-for cause, to which there are exceptions. And the first exception that we dealt with, or group of exceptions really, would be cases where the plaintiff can't identify which defendant, among many, caused the plaintiff's injury, but the plaintiff asks for some kind of modification of the normal test. And we saw the variety of different ways in which that might happen, the last of which was market share liability. And so we have one last case in that section, this lease case. And it applies the rule adopted in Sindel to a case involving defective plumbing equipment. Ms. Anderson, can you tell us about Edwards?
Edwards?
Yeah, Edwards versus Lease here. So apparently there were a series of manufacturers who sold this pipe to dealers, who in turn sold the pipe to installers and found their way into the plaintiff's homes. All kinds of different plaintiffs who purchased this pipe, and it turns out to be defective. What does the plaintiff or the group of plaintiffs want to do in assigning a liability? Okay. So what's the legal move that the plaintiffs want to make in this case?
They want to make a market share theory liability.
Okay. And what's their rationale for doing so?
They're for the or the alternative theory of liability.
Okay, now what would they need to establish a Summers versus Ice theory of liability? To qualify for that, you have to okay, so one of the things is that you have to have you have to be dealing from a full deck. So you have to be able to say, whoever caused my injury, although I don't know who it is, it's one of these people and they're all in the courtroom. I'm not missing some of the players in this game. Okay, so if the plaintiff, at least in some cases, could establish I've got all the players here, then Summers versus Tice might apply. The other thing you have to do in Summers versus Tice? Yeah, you have to show that all the defendants were negligent. So, again, if there are some defendants who may have used reasonable care, who used good pipe as opposed to defective pipe, then that wouldn't apply. However, if you could establish, gee, they all did the same thing, as in Sindel, they're all essentially using the same formula, the same pattern, the same failure to warn about its dangers in the case of asbestos, then this sort of universal failure on their part could be tacked on to this Summers versus Tice remedy. Now, to get a market share liability theory, what do they have to do? What would the plaintiffs have to do? Okay, but to qualify for that theory, to be able to play that game, just as with alternative liability, there are certain requirements. It's got to be a case where all the defendants are there, where each of them is negligent in a similar kind of way. What's the entry ticket to be able to play the market share liability game? What did we have in Sindel that made it appropriate to use a market share theory in Sindel, Ms. Brooks?
In Sindel, the plaintiff didn't know which of the manufacturers were there,
Okay, one of the things is that it's a little bit, again, analogous to the Ray Sipsis situation where there's some kind of missing evidence here. There's a reason why we're kind of going to one of these alternatives, because the normal process of identifying who it was and making your claim against them, that's impossible so unrealistic that it's not fair to place that burden on the plaintiff. And in fact, that becomes a very relevant issue here. Are we in a situation where we're unable to determine whose pipe caused the particular form of damage here?
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a bit of a hassle, you know, you got to dig the, you have to maybe pull the wallboard back or do something else, but we can, in fact, identify, okay, this pipe, by its markings or what have you, came from this manufacturer. There are ways of identifying, and at that point, primarily, the court says, We really don't think that a market share liability theory really fits here. What are the other concerns that the court has about using a market share liability in a case like this? Actually, let's back up for a second and ask the question, why, if the plaintiff could identify which manufacturer sold this pipe, why would the plaintiff even bother with the market share liability theory?
The plaintiff was trying to get to the wholesalers using market share.
Okay. To a broader group of defendants. What the plaintiff is looking for is the more invitations to this party, the more gifts might show up here. You invite 200 people to your wedding and maybe, shake that tree and maybe something will fall out of it. So, again, the plaintiffs get the benefit of a wider pool of defendants. But in a sense, the court is on to that and says, the basis for using market share liability is where you can't identify the group of defendants, or you can't identify which defendant caused your injury. In this case, that doesn't really apply. It's not a generic product like asbestos, or there are some problems with whether it's generic. But as the DES cases are the best example of a generic product, and you have claims against these other, your claims against the manufacturers are being mixed in with your claims against the wholesalers. And so the court says, in effect, look, we have some flexibility here, but we have to kind of revert to the policy reasons why we do or do not use these exceptions to the normal rule, and before we sort of forge boldly ahead to try to apply these theories, we have to think about whether or not it really fits. Okay? Can the plaintiffs use an alternative liability theory? If market share doesn't work, does they discuss here the use of Summers versus Tice? Ortiz? Again, the same kind of rationale here, that when in doubt, leave it out. If you don't need this kind of a remedy, this dispensation, it doesn't really apply. So again, it in a way illustrates the same thing I've said about exam-taking strategy. When you have a hammer, you go around looking for nails to pound, but that doesn't always satisfy the fact that you could, you know, make this hammer, you know, whack on this particular object doesn't mean it's a suitable use of this particular doctrine or this particular tool. So again, I tend to assign you cases to read in which the court is resolving doubts in favor of being creative in terms of expanding the rule of liability or taking a walk on the wild side, but remember that oftentimes the court will say thanks but no thanks. And so think about that as you're evaluating the likelihood that a doctrine would help you out. Okay, again, this whole first section of exceptions has to do with cases in which the plaintiff says, I'm having difficulty meeting the normal but-for test, but I want an accommodation. I want a modification of the standard to fit my particular circumstances. And the next two sections, loss of a chance and multiple redundant causes, we have a different problem that confronts the plaintiff, but it's similar in the sense that the plaintiff is saying, don't hold me to the traditional test. I need a dispensation. And the question is whether for policy reasons that's something that the court will or will decline to do. Mr. Christopoulos.
I have a question regarding market.
Yeah.
Can it be applied to different people in the so-called food chain? Sindel has two manufacturers. In this case, they're looking at...
I'm sorry, did you say Sindel had...
Had looked at two manufacturers, right? They were...
Actually, in Sindel, there were literally hundreds of manufacturers.
Oh, hundreds, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
And in this case, we're looking at contractors, manufacturers.
Well, if you're looking at different levels of the food chain, they don't really occupy it. It's a lot harder to use this kind of market share allocation. If I'm in sort of a vertical relationship, or at least I'm not in a horizontal relationship in which I'm doing the same thing as all these other people, selling a product, and you can identify what out of 100%, what percent belongs to me. Once you start mixing different levels of the food chain, this kind of model breaks down. Again, that was part of the problem in lease, that the court was saying you're sort of mixing apples and oranges here. So again, the issue is, have you properly identified a case where the defendants as a group are competing in the same market, and by looking at sales data, we can divide it up into 10% here and 14% there and 25% someplace else. If that's not true, then we don't have that kind of a case. In fact, For example, in the asbestos cases, they started to use that as an analogy, and one of the difficulties in the asbestos cases is that the exposure people get, the asbestos fibers are all functionally equivalent, these little sort of like corkscrews, the asbestos fibers that get inhaled and then lodge in the lining of the lungs or lodge in the lungs themselves, and these little irritants, essentially, they're carcinogenic. That's why asbestos is carcinogenic. And the fibers themselves are essentially fungible. One looks just like the other. But the medium from which the fibers come will vary. So it may be brake linings, or it may be the insulation that's used on a furnace or a boiler or a steam tunnel, or, you know, it may be asbestos fibers that are used. At one time, asbestos was used in linoleum. By the way, asbestos is this almost, magical. The reason it was so widely used before the environmental health concerns is it's this, you know, it doesn't burn. It's got these, you know, these long sort of fiber things that function as a small reinforcement, same way you use wood fibers to make paper, so it holds this goop together in a sheet of paper. So, you know, asbestos was really this marvelous stuff that was very widely used until people said, wait a minute, you know, what happens when you have cumulative exposure to this and you have all sorts of problems? So, again, whether, for example, the asbestos workers who at one time might be using a cement with asbestos fibers in the cement or a big insulation blanket that's being placed and taped together around a big steam tunnel, whether the products were generic such that you could say there's a market for these products, or whether you're saying, well, there's a market for cement, there's a market for asbestos insulation blankets, there's a market for brakes, but they're not fungible. So again, the sort of technical question of what things really belong to the same, you know, generic pool that can be divided up is itself a technical question that you would, again, be likely to litigate, the plaintiff arguing that they are generic, the defendant that they are generic and therefore market share liability can apply, the defendant arguing, no, they're not generic, and therefore market share liability is inapplicable. So, again, without going too far down that road, we could probably spend a whole class talking about, I mean, a whole, you know, semester talking about the sub-issues of market share liability, you can sort of see the way in which these things would become very important, particularly in a class action where you've got hundreds or thousands of plaintiffs and a lot of money at stake. Okay, so again, we're shifting now from this problem of not being able to identify which defendant caused the injury to a different set of problems. And the first one we have is loss of a chance. And we start with this case of Dillon versus Legg. Who wants to tell us about Dillon versus Legg? Mr. Jones, go ahead.
Plaintiff contested the boy of 14. He was playing on a bridge that was maintained by the defendants. He and other boys climbed up to the second level of the bridge to jump off into the water. There's an electrical wire that ran the lights on the lower level of the bridge. The boy lost his balance, grabbed on the wire, and was electrocuted.
So we got the sort of water down here. The boy's up, there's a bridge. The boy's up here playing on some kind of level of the bridge, falls off the bridge, and is killed. No, he doesn't fall off the bridge.
He grabs onto the wire.
Grabs onto the wire, yeah. He's The question is, what would have happened if he had fallen again? Okay. So, what's the trial procedure here? What happens when the case goes to trial?
Resulted in disagreement?
Most cases start with a disagreement. This one apparently ended in... What does that mean, so far as you can tell?
That the jury couldn't agree on what to decide.
Okay, so why are we looking at it? If the jury couldn't agree on something, wouldn't you just send it back to the jury and have them, you know, you declare a mistrial? That's what happens. You may know the judges really don't like mistrials. They don't want to go through all that work and then go through all that work again. They try, they ask the jury, plead with the jury, you know, without violating anybody's conscience and forcing them to make a decision they don't want to make. Can you talk to one another long enough to have people change their minds and we can arrive at a verdict? Well, apparently they couldn't do that. So why do we have this case now?
Well, the way that the appellate court looked at it is sort of a matter of law.
Okay. Somebody argues that it's a matter of law. Who argues that this case involves a decision which is not for the jury but is a matter of law? Defendant says, don't bother to retry this case. The proper thing to do is to dismiss it. What's the defendant's argument as to why it should be dismissed?
That if it weren't for the current in the water, he would have fallen anyway and died. Or
then why is that relevant? Why does that entitle the defendant to judgment as a matter of law?
Because if they didn't deprive him of his life, they deprived him of the 15 seconds that it would take him to hit the bridge, or the life that he would have led after being damned.
Well, they don't concede that. They don't concede that he would have had a life. Of any kind, their pitch is, legally speaking again, they line up the plaintiff's burden of proof. Plaintiff has to prove that we were negligent, says the defendant. Okay, maybe there was evidence in the record that shows we were negligent. So sue us. No. Okay, so maybe the Chapter 1 issue has been properly presented, but with respect to Chapter 2, the plaintiff, as a matter of law, has not met... they have not met their burden. And that burden, again...
prove that this is a proximate cause of the death.
And specifically, what aspect of the proximate cause test can...
That it was a but-for cause.
Yeah. The defendant says that no reasonable jury could conclude, based on this evidence, that the electrification of this wire is a cause without which the injury, namely the death, could have been prevented. And again, the defendant, it correctly states the legal test that the plaintiff must prove that even if the defendant was negligent, that's not enough. The plaintiff's got to show that negligence is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. And again, their argument based on the facts is, falling from this height, if we didn't have a wire there for him to grab onto, he would have been just as dead. His body would have been, you know, mangled instead of burned, but dead is dead. No harm, no foul, says the defendant. What does the court say to that argument?
Agreed. They said there was a chance that he maybe wouldn't have died. But
how large is that chance?
Not very.
I don't think that the appellate court makes that final determination. Ms. Griff? Okay. The appellate court does say that the question of how large that chance was whether it got above 50% in effect. They don't use the percentages, but they say, based on this evidence, a reasonable jury could find that if it weren't for the current in that wire, he would have fallen, been badly hurt, but more probably than not, he would have survived but for the current. The appellate court is not saying that is the case. It remains for a jury to make that determination. But if viewing the evidence, you know, and maybe they take the crash test dummies out there, push them off the bridge, and, you know, count the number of times that they land safely, you know, that they land in the water, or they land in such a way that it was a survivable fall, and the number of times that, you know, that there would appear that this would be a fatal fall. So the question to be put to the jury now for them to resolve one way or the other, hopefully they'll get a verdict out of the jury this time, is what say you, members of the jury? Is it more likely he would have died anyway, or is it more likely he would have survived, albeit with serious injuries? If it's the latter, the plaintiff gets a verdict. The verdict, the amount of damages would be for the difference between dying and surviving, albeit in this injured condition. Again, the jury could easily come back and say, based on the evidence and the data and the testimony, we think, sadly, he would have died anyway. Therefore, we find for the defendant, but that will be for the jury. Now, the reason I give you this case is to sort of set up a hypothetical here to figure out what we would do. Suppose the jury came back to us and said, we think that he had a 40% chance of landing safely, but a 60% chance that he would have died. What do they do then? What's that? I don't think we have a market for falling bodies here. Again, because market share is solving a different kind of problem. Market share is solving the problem we don't know who did what. Here we know who did what, but we have a different kind of problem.
You could go with more probably than not. Would that anyway?
Okay, the law appears to say that, well, let's actually start with a different hypothetical. I'm agreeing with you, but just to clarify, let's switch it around. Suppose the jury finds that there's a 60% chance he would have survived and a 40% chance that he would have been killed. And let's suppose the 60% chance is that he would land in the water and, you know, he would have been... it's no fun to hit the water at, you know, from a height of 60 feet if you've ever gone off the really high dive and missed your dive. It hurts, but suppose he would have survived that and lived a fairly normal life after that. 60% chance that would have happened, 40% chance he would have fallen on the rocks and been killed. What happens? What's the outcome of that case? What does the boy or the boy's family recover? No. Well, he didn't. But what we're testing is the. And remember that in all of these cases, we do a kind of. A hypothetical thought experiment. We say, what if the defendant had used reasonable care? If the defendant had used reasonable care and had moved this wire, so instead of reaching out and grabbing a 14,000, whatever this high voltage line is, and getting electrocuted, there would have been no wire there, and he falls without getting electrocuted. Now, we know he's actually dead, but to figure out whether the defendant should be held liable, we ask the question, what would have happened if they had used reasonable care? And our conclusion is, if they had used reasonable care, moved the wire, 60% chance he would have survived, 40% chance he would have been killed anyway. Then what? Mr. Glover?
Well, isn't it over 50% that he would have lived, and then they would have just awarded damage for a whole
lot? He wins. Yeah. He doesn't get 60% of his damages. He's met the test, and he wins. Now, getting back to Mr. Moore's response here, suppose it's the other way around. Suppose it's a 40% chance that he would have survived, but a 60% chance he would have died. Then what? The rule is, yeah, he gets nothing. So we have this kind of on-off switch in which it's either you get everything or you get nothing. There's no kind of subtlety involved here. Nothing in between. Ms. Griff? I'm making them up. Well, I'm sorry, say that again. Well, the reason I'm using numbers is to kind of put some specificity to the verbal formula. The verbal formula is the plaintiff's burden is to show more probably than not this is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Now, when we say more probably than not, when we talk about probabilities, what's the probability that I'm going to win the lottery? You know, it's 1 in 40 million or something. What's the probability that I'm going to be able to drive safely from here back to my house? 99.99%. There is a chance that's not going to happen, but it's a very small one. What is the likelihood that it's going to be sunny tomorrow? 60%, 40%. You know, we sort of look at different probabilities, some very low probabilities, some very high probabilities. Again, the plaintiff's burden in a case like this is to say, we can say more probably than not, something different would have happened if the defendant had used reasonable care. So if that, in a world of probabilities, is essentially at the 50% mark, what happens if the plaintiff is slightly above that? Going back to Mrs. Reynolds, she acknowledges, okay, there's a chance I might have fallen anyway, even if the defendant had provided adequate light. But if I meet the test of showing, well, more probably than not, I would have made it safely down the stairs, she wins. And we don't deduct from her award the possibility that she might have fallen anyway. Similarly, when the defendant or when the plaintiff can't meet that test, can show that there was a chance of avoiding this accident which the defendant took away through the defendant's negligence, but the chance of surviving even with reasonable care by the defendant was less than 50%, the traditional rule would say, sorry, you lose. It's like a light switch that's either on or it's off. Now, as a policy matter, you could suggest that's a little crude. Instead of being forced to say it's either all or it's nothing, using the analogy of a light switch, could we install a dimmer switch here where we can vary the award based upon the evidence regarding how likely or unlikely it was that if the defendant had used reasonable care, this injury could have been avoided. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay?
What if it's exactly 50%? Does that ever happen?
Well, in theory, it can, and it's not so much that we have exactly, you know, statistics in 50.00%, but what is very plausible is that the jury looks at the facts and they're left completely undecided. They're not saying the plaintiff wouldn't have survived, but they also can't say the plaintiff would have survived. They're just left, you know, it's as likely to be one as the other. In a case like that, it is the plaintiff with the burden of proof, and, you know, sort of the baseball analogy here, the tie goes to the defendant rather than to the plaintiff, just as the tie goes to the runner rather than the fielder in baseball. The tie goes to the defendant, or the tie goes to the non-moving party, to put it more generically. If you have the burden of proof, it's your job to get to persuade the judge or the jury to get over that, you know, midpoint and say, it doesn't have to be by much, but you still have to say, well, if I have to choose, I'd say more probably than not, it's this rather than that. So again, if the jury is left with the feeling, gee, it's just as likely to be one as the other, the plaintiff's failed. And certainly, if the jury is left with the impression, you know, there was a pretty decent chance of recovery, but that chance of recovery was forfeited because of the defendant's negligence, the traditional rule says that's not enough. Mr. Ortiz?
Who determines what the conflict is? Would a judge say, I mean, if you're advocating for the plaintiff, you're saying 60-40 in my way, the defense is going to say 60-40 the other way, and it goes to the jury. The jury interprets which is which.
The jury typically doesn't have, you know, a probability sheet, but it might be to the advantage of the plaintiff or the defendant to actually run, you know, to do some testing. I mean, if I were the plaintiff or the defendant and there were a lot of money at stake in a case like this, I might quietly, you know, hire a consultant with the crash test dummies, you know, and get the weather report for that day, get somebody to, you know, maybe drop some kind of thing off the bridge at that point with the wind blowing in whatever direction it was that day, and sort of, you know, keep track of where does it wind up. And again, you may have lots of conflict. Some people would say there was a strong wind blowing this way. Some people might say, oh, he was over here, he was on this girder. No, he was over, although I guess the position of his body, when they recover his body, they would have some pretty good idea where he was when he lost his balance and began to fall. But again, you might have some dispute about the conditions, and such that it might make a difference as to where, you know, what his trajectory was. But that conflict in testimony, Mr. Lynch, I'm sorry, I misnamed you there earlier. Sorry. The problem in the conflict of the testimony would be one that the jury has to resolve. So they take the evidence, and whether it's stated in the form of probabilities, when we pushed a crash test dummy over the edge with a 10-mile-an-hour wind going this way, 8 times out of 10, it fell on the rocks and you can infer a fatal injury. That kind of evidence is the stuff you present to the jury, or you may simply do it on the basis of appealing to the jury's more intuitive, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this is a terrible accident, you know, we grieve for the family, but look at the evidence. This boy was 60 feet above this pile of jagged rocks. Electrocution or no electrocution, this tragedy was going to happen anyway, and you can't, ladies and you took an oath before you started this case that you would apply the law to the facts. And the law says they have to prove to you more probably than not he would have survived, and that's not the case. So that's the sort of thing that you would do to try to persuade the jury, don't make a finding in the plaintiff's favor, but it's probably, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be on the basis of a spreadsheet and statistical evidence, but it would be that test of can I or can I not meet the standard that the law sets out. Mr. Glover?
Why does a case like this ever make it past summary judgment for the defendant? I mean, the kid's on a bridge where he's probably not supposed to be.
Okay, now.
Falls and grabs a wire. I mean.
Okay, now that goes to the question, you know, at least as I hear it, you're addressing what I would call liability questions, or at least fault questions. And one of the principles going back to the very first case turntable, you know, sulfuric acid pool case we read, the question of whether a child, how old is this kid?
14.
Still legally a child here, whether this child was in effect either, you know, lured onto this, you know, is whether it's an attractive nuisance, how negligent the defendants were in allowing the kids to play there, the fact that apparently at some time during the day there were times when this wire was not hot. There were times when it was hot. So, again, it could be this case is enough like this pool of sulfuric acid where the kids were doing what kids do, and you would say, at least we have some issue about whether the defendants were negligent and whether the boy was himself at fault or whether the boy was doing something kids do and it was the defendant's job to put up signs or keep them out or otherwise monitor this terribly dangerous situation. So again, that part of it, I think, was close enough to get to the jury. Maybe that was the place where the jury got into this unbridgeable gap where some thought that the defendant was at fault and some thought otherwise, but anyway, we wound up looking for purposes of appeal solely at the question of causation. Assuming you could establish liability, does the case still fail because the causation element is lacking? Okay, now to follow up on this whole idea of whether or not you want to sort of expand your horizon here, have a place for some different kind of theory, we have Hardy versus Southwestern Bell. And, yeah, Ms. Spring? Are you a Garth Brooks fan? Is that why you... No, go ahead, sorry. Okay, and let's just sort of again review the bidding here with respect to chapter one. What would you have to show if you're the plaintiff in this case with respect to chapter one? What do you have to show? Right, and how would you go about doing that? Yeah. Exactly. Custom of the industry, maybe a learned hand test, you know, company. There are all sorts of ways that you could sort of establish a reasonable person operating a 911 system would not have had this happen. They, you know, they could have easily foreseen when the Garth Brooks tickets go on sale, the phone lines are going to be jammed. So how do you design a system that doesn't have that a feature? Okay, but we have a separate chapter 2 problem here. And what's the nature of the chapter 2 problem?
Whether or not the lockup was the fact that there was a causal relationship.
Right, And again, I prefer the indefinite article there. Whether it's a proximate cause, but you're right in terms of whether it was a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. What's the evidence on that point? As to whether or not the failure to have a working 911 system caused this woman's death. What's the evidence on that point?
Well, I don't think it has any proof
of
evidence because
there's
other factors that
are in play. And just when you said, you know, whether it was the proximate cause of the injury, and I, you know, so he flinched and said, whether it's a proximate cause of the injury, after all, what caused her death? A heart attack, yeah. So in that sense, the only question is, what role did the 911 system play? And according to the plaintiff, the role the 911 system played was what? In what respect? How did it approximately cause her death? Yeah, if she had gotten more prompt medical attention, she would have survived. But on that very question, we have evidence. Whether or not prompt medical attention would have saved her, what's the evidence? In her condition, and again, you would have probably a technical fight among the, you know, you cherry pick your statistics so that you got just the statistics you wanted, but you could have a statistical study that showed a woman of her age with this kind of heart condition, even with prompt medical attention, 60% of the time she dies anyway. It is probable that the lack of medical attention made no difference. So what's the plaintiff complaining about?
Well, that it was enough of a burden for her to cause.
Okay, and what's the concept behind a loss of a chance theory?
It's normally applied to medical malpractice, and it reduces the standard of causation to be true.
Okay, and let's see where that's coming from in the medical context. I go to the doctor. Let's suppose I've got a shoulder injury, and there's a form of surgery which, if properly done, 40% of the time will restore full motion to my arm instead of leaving me with this, you know, painful, limited range of motion. The doctor negligently fails to perform the surgery correctly, and there's a one-time shot to do this. The doctor bungles it. I'm left permanently with an injured shoulder. What's my argument? And what do I get out of that case? Suppose that the value of a full range of motion as opposed to limited range of motion, just for simplicity's sake, suppose we assess the damages at $100,000, what does the plaintiff receive from a medical malpractice case based upon the loss of a 40% chance of recovery? No. It's the discounted value. It's the 40% chance. It's looking at it sort of like a lottery ticket. Suppose I have one of the lottery tickets that goes into some big final drawing, and of these three lottery tickets, one gets picked for the, you know, $10 million prize. Chances are that ticket, I mean, statistically speaking, chances are that that ticket will turn out to be worthless. Because there's a two-thirds chance it's worthless and a one-third chance it'll pay me $10 million. Does that ticket have value? You bet. Leaving aside, you know, risk aversion or risk preference, the actuarial value of that ticket is $3.33 million. Because it's a one-third chance of getting $10 million. So if I had a 40% chance of getting full range of motion back in my shoulder and the doctor negligently took that away from me, I should get sort of the lottery ticket version of that, a 40% of $100,000, $40,000. Now, again, this represents a departure from the normal rule, which says if you get to 60%, suppose the statistics on that surgery were such that 60% of the time it's successful and 40% of the time we can't really do much for you. If the doctor negligently messed it up, I get my $100,000. But if I'm down in the loss of a chance region where I'm getting just a chance, my lottery ticket version, the law says in medical malpractice cases, you can get this discounted value. Now, the question before the House in this case has to do with the transferability of medical malpractice law to 911 law. What law will we apply to operators of 911 systems? Will we apply the same loss of a chance theory to allow the plaintiff in this case to recover the value of the chance that she lost? Or will we say to her, no, sorry lady, you're in the same position as people who suffer automobile accidents or anything else. It's all or nothing. What's the court's response to whether they're going to use this medical malpractice theory applied to 911 cases? Okay, why did they choose to do it in medical malpractice cases?
Just because there was a lot of situations where
the nature of the relationship, which you mentioned earlier, strangely, in the medical malpractice cases, one of the rationales for using loss of a chance is that otherwise doctors would simply, you know, put a little smiley face sticker on the chart of people who only had a 40% chance of survival. There's this one, they can't touch me. So what if I mess it up? They weren't long for this world anyway. If I'm performing surgery where there's only a 40% chance of success, so what if I mess it up? Now, for some reason, courts looking at such cases thought, oh no, we can't have that. Let's adopt a loss of a chance theory, lest medical professionals begin kind of, you know, triaging their patients according to which ones could sue them and which ones can't. Now, I think this takes a rather dim view of the medical profession, that the sole reason they treat people is because, you know, they're afraid of lawsuits, and once you eliminate the fear of a lawsuit, they're going to treat you like cattle. But for whatever reason, that seemed to be persuasive. Plus the fact, again, in the medical profession, we have fairly good statistics. We can say for a 60-year-old woman with a history of, you know, a previous heart attack and, you know, that these statistics, here is the likelihood that she will survive a, you know, heart attack with prompt medical care. We've got those statistics. We don't have those statistics applied to 911 operators because we don't have the same sort of regularity and statistical database. We can't really talk apples to apples. Even in the medical context, as I say, depending on what statistical basis you use, you could say, oh, well, maybe as a group, 60-year-old women with one previous heart attack have only a 40% chance of survival, but people in Snohomish County who, you know, lived, who are in this occupation or who are in this weight class or whose, you know, pulse rate was below this level or some other characteristic, gee, for those people, they had a 60% chance of survival. Let's use that as our comparison database rather than the one the defendant chose to use. So once you get into the game of figuring out statistical odds of survival, which in either using or not using loss of a chance you're going to have to use, there's the expression, there used to be a book, How to Lie with Statistics. You know, the use of statistical data is increasingly important in resolving questions about legal liability. Ms. Woodruff?
I was just wondering, in a case of a bone marrow transplant, there's maybe a 2% or 5%.
You could do a loss of a chance thing and you say, hey, my son or my relative had a 2% chance of survival if you'd done this bone marrow transplant correctly, but instead you got, you know, the samples mixed up or you didn't match the blood types properly and so it had a fatal outcome. I acknowledge, of course, that even with proper care, he only had a 2% chance of survival, but I want my 2%. Again, in the medical context, for improper medical care, you can do the loss of a chance. But outside that context, the courts say, sorry, you're restricted to the traditional test in which you either prove more probably than not this injury would have occurred, or you don't. Either you meet the burden and get everything, or you don't meet the burden and you get nothing. In most cases outside medical malpractice, we don't have this dimmer switch where we can vary the recovery based upon the likelihood of survival.
Does the dimmer switch stop at the more probable?
Yes, it does.
So if you're 50% or above, full recovery.
Exactly. See, and that's another policy rationale, in addition to the ones offered here. It's not like medical malpractice. We don't have statistical data. We don't have this worry that people are going to go around, you know, marking their medical charts with the ones we don't have to worry about. But the other reason for rejecting loss of a chance is that essentially the plaintiff ought to take the bitter with the sweet. You know, the sweet for the plaintiff is you get up above that 50% margin, Mrs. Reynolds gets a full recovery, even though she acknowledges I might have fallen anyway. So if you're going to get the benefit of our crude but effective system here, then you ought to be, reciprocally limited to those cases where you get above that. If the defendant gets the worst of both worlds, that can hardly be fair. The defendant has to pay everything when the plaintiff gets above 50%, but when the plaintiff's below 50%, they start playing the percentage game. Well, that doesn't seem quite equitable.
So you are saying that if it's 60% in a medical case, and you only recover 60%?
No.
It is full recovery.
You get a full recovery. It's only in the medical context that courts have recognized this loss of a chance theory. Interestingly, in legal malpractice cases, you have a similar kind of issue. What happens if the plaintiff's lawyer blows the statute of limitations, but we're not sure, well, even if the plaintiff hadn't missed the statute of limitations, would the plaintiff have gotten a recovery? Do you think that loss of a chance is applied to lawyers as it is to doctors? But no. The rule in legal malpractice cases is that what they have what is called a case within a case. Remember in Hamlet, you know, the plays the thing to catch the conscience of a king. So Hamlet puts on this play with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, portraying what he thinks is the murder. You know, it's portraying sort of what he thinks happened between his father and his stepfather to try to figure out if this guy's reacting like he recognized. Okay, so the play within a play, you have a case within a case in a legal malpractice situation where you basically try the case, not for the purpose of finding out whether the defendant has to pay, that is, the original person who was in the automobile accident, you find out whether the lawyer has to pay who missed the statute of limitations. And if the jury says, yeah, we find that the plaintiff had a good claim, then you, and we also find that the defendant was, the lawyer defendant was guilty of malpractice, then the defendant lawyer has to pay whatever the jury awarded. The theory being that unlike medical cases where we can't, you know, prop the person up and find out, okay, with medical care, how well would, you know, Mrs. Hardy have fared, we can do that since law doesn't have the physical boundaries that medicine does. So, anyway, a disanalogy there between law and medicine. Okay, let's take our 10-minute break here and come back and look at multiple redundant clauses.
On the day, she just go to your secretary and ask for the test. Is that correct?